Which incentives would make you change your behaviour, make you do something you ought to do, like get to work on time, do your tax return, or exercise every day? What kind of prompting would work? A carrot or a stick? This is no trivial issue. Whether withdrawing government payments or giving financial incentives can influence behaviour is a hot topic amongst economists right now. In some American cities, students in disadvantaged schools are actually being paid to turn up, while in Australia, welfare payments for some are cut if their children don't attend class regularly. With me now to talk about this is Professor Andrew Lee from the Australian National University in another instalment of our new series, Right Side Economics. Hi, Andrew.
Good morning, Richard.
What's the economic logic behind these schemes? Firstly, penalising welfare recipients if their kids don't attend school regularly.
Well, the simple logic is that people respond to incentives. This is, I suppose, economics 101, the way we think about a lot of these problems. And that for kids, kids often have very high discount rates. In other words, they put too low a value on future happiness and too high a value on current happiness. Most kids would be better off finishing high school. But we know that part of this neurological research suggesting the prefrontal cortex develops late, kids are very bad at sort of making these trade-offs. And so we can actually make them better in a lifetime sense by creating incentives to stay on at school. This is why we have a compulsory school leaving age, for example.
Yes.
Because we think that kids are not able to make the right decision as to how much education to get, and that otherwise some kids would choose mistakenly to drop out at 12 or 13.
Well, go on.
And then sort of extending on from that is the notion that perhaps in some cases we ought to use carrots or sticks. We ought to either take away welfare or add additional payments for attending school.
Well, what we do in Australia in some remote Indigenous communities in particular is take away welfare. It is early days, but do we know whether these kind of punishments work?
We have relatively little evidence on the taking away welfare experiments. The one study which I would put a reasonable amount of faith in is one by Thomas Dee assessing a Wisconsin program, which did pretty much what the Northern Territory programs do, as I understand it. And he finds an effect there, about a 4 percentage point increase in enrollment for a program which sanctions poor attendance at school by reducing welfare. Interestingly, in his program, the stick isn't applied very often. Over a 2-year period, only a tenth of the families end up having any sanctions. But the very presence, the potential of a stick seems to have an impact.
Yes, it's to encourage the others, isn't it? As much
exactly.
as anything else.
Exactly. And ideally, you wouldn't want anyone to be sanctioned out of this. You'd just like to have the stick there and never have to use it and see the boost in enrollment.
The other approach is payment or even prizes for school attendance. Now, that's happening in America too. They have a scheme called, I think it's Learn Fair. How does that work?
Yeah, so the US scheme is actually an interesting instance of developed countries learning from developing countries. One of the hot ideas in development economics over the last decade or so has been these conditional cash transfers. The original experiment was one in 1997 in Mexico, which took 300,000 families and provided additional payments to those families whose kids attended school. It seemed to work so well that they've now rolled it out across the country. So 20 million Mexican families now get receive these additional payments if their kids show up for school. Argentina, Honduras, Colombia, Turkey, a whole bunch of other developing countries have taken this on. And then it takes a decade, but then various US cities have said, well, we have real challenges in getting the poorest kids to school and getting them to stay on and get good grades. Maybe we could learn something from these developing country experiments.
Well, is it working? Is school attendance in America improving where this is being tried?
It works in developing countries. As far as I know, we don't have any results out of the US studies so far. What's important about all these studies is they're randomised trials, so they're pretty much like we'd test a new pharmaceutical. So anything we get out of them, I'm much more inclined to believe than I would be if we were, for example, making a comparison between people who opted into the program and opted out of the program. That just wouldn't be a reasonable comparison. But this would be gold standard evidence when we get it out. The critics say, well, what you do when you provide these extrinsic motivations, put some cash on the table, is you crowd out the intrinsic motivations.
Well, I had the pleasure of introducing Michael Sandel in the Wreath Lectures, which we broadcast recently here on Radio National. And that is exactly his point, that you corrupt the intrinsic joy of learning.
Absolutely. So there is very strong theory on this, and then the challenge is to take it to the data. In developing countries, there's little evidence, for example, that when these programs stop for a period, that you see a drop off in a drop back below the baseline. So if you'd crowded out intrinsic motivations, you would expect to see that when you stop the program, things got worse than they were to begin with. You don't see that. You would also expect that you saw some sort of crowd out in subjects where you weren't rewarding. So some of these programs reward good grades. If you reward good math and reading grades, you'd then expect to, if the intrinsic motivation theory is right, you'd expect to see a drop, say, in social studies or geography. You don't seem to see that either. So it's a strong theory. We've got a little bit of evidence out of the psychology studies in the lab, but when we actually take it to real kids, it doesn't seem to work that way.
Okay, so carrots, as in developing countries and parts of America, or sticks, which we're using in some indigenous communities in Australia, which approach brings the best results?
Well, the thing I like about the carrots approach is administratively it can be a lot simpler. So if you're sanctioning welfare payments, you need to think really carefully about what am I going to do if the child is sick? What am I going to do if there's a funeral in the family, for example? And then you need to have a whole set of rules and sort of procedures for appeal and so on, because in some sense you're taking away an income support payment that is regarded as a right. If we're putting additional money on the table, you need to worry about that much less. You can simply say kids who show up regularly or kids who get a reasonable grade will receive this reward payment. And you can also reward grades with a carrot payment, whereas I don't think we would regard it as reasonable to sanction benefits if children didn't make a certain grade in school.
So it's in fact administratively easier as well as perhaps more elegant.
Yes, exactly. I mean, this runs into sort of odd debates in Indigenous policy in Australia. When I try to pitch this to, say, friends at the Cape York Institute, they're less keen about the notion of providing additional money. So I think it politically it might be tough to do, but practically, if we could, for example, pay every Indigenous kid in Australia $20 a week for turning up to school, potentially I think that'd be money well spent. First, I'd like to do it on a small sample and get rigorous evidence.
Did you ever watch The Wire, Andrew? You know, it's now on, people watch it on DVD.
I didn't, no.
Okay, there's a scene in Series 3 where it's clear that the school is being paid by the city to make sure its truancy numbers are not too high. But once they've got those numbers for the month, they stop paying people to go out and round up the kids. So any system, I suppose, it can be gamed, and the key here is to design one where it's most difficult to game, or it's just not worth the effort.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. But you know, let's face it, affluent parents have been paying kids for good grades for a long time, and many well-off parents regard that as a good way of improving the incentives for kids to attend school. And many rich kids in suburbs of Sydney or Melbourne get $20 a week. So I see nothing wrong with providing an extra $20 a week to Indigenous kids in remote communities to do the right thing. Morally, I'm quite comfortable with that. Practically, I think it would work, but I'd like some rock solid evidence before I rolled it out nationwide.
All right, still on learning. Let's talk about class sizes. Making class sizes smaller, especially for the first year or so of school, have been very politically popular. And you can see why. It's easy to think smaller class sizes mean better outcomes. But do they?
The theory has got to be right. So if you've got fewer kids in the class, it must be possible to improve the quality of student learning. And the question is whether that actually plays out in practice. You can imagine ways in which it wouldn't. For example, the teacher doesn't change his or her teaching style, or uses effectively what you're doing is providing the teacher with a little bit of additional leisure rather than ensuring that they use more time on the remaining students. So what you want, again, is sort of rigorous randomized evidence. We don't have very much. We have one study out of Tennessee in 1985, which finds positive effects of smaller classes, but with sort of perverse incentives. They set up the study in a funny kind of way, where they basically promised the teacher unions in the state that if the smaller classes did better, then class sizes would be cut statewide. So people sort of worry that created these kind of what we call Hawthorne effects, that the people who were observed knew they were an experiment and behaved differently. Some of the earlier randomised trials don't seem to support class sizes, and you know there's other evidence around that I find pretty believable that seems to suggest that cutting class sizes isn't money terribly well spent. But it's so popular in Australia.
Well, how could we test it now? Because as you say, some of the experiments go back a long way, early last century. How, I mean, it's a difficult thing to test. Because as soon as you say, this is what we're going to test, someone's going to say, oh, you're mucking around with these kids' futures.
I would be quite comfortable sending my child to a school where half the kids were in classes where the class size had been cut by 10% and the other half were in the same size classes as anywhere else in the state. I wouldn't regard that as being an experiment that I would be uncomfortable having my child in. My guess, based on my read of the evidence overall, is that the kids in the smaller classes wouldn't do better. But I think we ought to trial it. We ought to trial it at different levels. We might want to see, for example, whether Indigenous kids are better off with a class that is 10% smaller or a teacher who is 10% better paid.
Ah, yes. See, that's the other way you could do it, isn't it? I mean, and both of those things teacher unions have been keen on. Better pay, well, if you go back 30 or 35 years, teachers were relatively much better paid than they are now.
That's right. So if we go back to the 1970s, the typical young woman leaving a teacher education course was earning about a fifth more than the typical young woman leaving another university degree. And that's slowly been eroded. If we just look over the last two decades, then we've seen about a 10% drop in teacher salaries relative to all other employees or relative to all other university graduates. So teachers are not earning less, but they're slipping backwards in relative terms to the rest of the workforce.
So that's where you'd like to put the money, rather than in smaller class sizes, which have been intensely politically popular. Actually, just give that extra money to the teachers.
There's different ways you could do it. You could raise teacher salaries across the board, or you could think about some way of rewarding the best. Either, I think, would probably be better than class size reductions. The odd story of the last 20 years, which isn't told terribly much, is that we've seen class size reductions in the order of about 10%, and we've seen teacher salaries slip in the order of about 10% relative to other occupations. So effectively, teachers have paid for the class size cuts out of their own wallets. If we had the class size cuts of the class sizes of 20 years ago, the starting teacher could be earning another $5,000. A top of the scale teacher could be earning, say, another $8,000. So that's real money, and you might think that would potentially attract more effective people into the teaching profession.
Andrew, we could go on about this, but we won't. It has been fascinating. I'll see you next month.
Lovely. Look forward to it.
That's Professor Andrew Lee, who's an economist at the Research School of Social Sciences at the Australian National University and has, I always think, a very interesting mind. Next on Life Matters, one woman's story of going back and reconciling the past.